This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Dialogue, the art of verbal action for page, stage, and screen. Written by Robert McKee. Read by Robert McKee with scenes by David Pitou and Orla Cassidy. Please refer to the PDF that accompanies this audiobook.
For Mia, when she speaks, my heart listens. Preface, in praise of dialogue. We talk. Talk, more than any other trait, expresses our humanity. We whisper to lovers, curse enemies, argue with plumbers, praise the dog, swear on our mother's grave. Human relationships are, in essence, long, long talks into, around, through, and out of the entanglements that stress or bless our days. Face-to-face talk between family and friends may go on for decades, while self-to-self talk never ends. A guilt-ridden conscience scolds unconscionable desires. Ignorance ridicules wisdom, hope consoles despair, impulse mocks caution, and wit laughs at it all as the inner voices of our best and worst selves argue to our last breath. Over decades, this downpour of talk can drain words of their meaning, and when meaning erodes, our days shallow out. But what time dilutes, story condenses. Authors concentrate meaning by first eliminating the banalities, minutiae, and repetitious chatter of daily life. They then build their tellings into a crisis of complex, conflicting desires. Under pressure, words fill with connotation and nuance. What a character says in the face of conflict radiates the meanings hidden behind her words. Expressive dialogue becomes a translucency, through which readers and audiences perceive thoughts and feelings shadowed in the silence behind a character's eyes. Fine writing turns audiences and readers into virtual psychics. Dramatized dialogue has the power to unite two unspoken realms, the inner life of a character and the inner life of the reader audience. Like radio transmitters, one subconscious tunes to another, as our instincts sense the churnings within characters. As Kenneth Burke put it, stories equip us to live in the world in intimacy with others and, most importantly, in intimacy with ourselves. Authors give us this power through a series of steps. First, they create those metaphors for human nature we call characters. Next, they dig into the characters' psychologies to unearth conscious wishes and subconscious desires, those longings that impel inner and outer selves. With this insight in hand, writers clash the character's most compelling desires into flashpoints of conflict. Scene after scene, they interlace their character's actions and reactions around turning points of change. In a last step, authors let their characters speak, but not in the repetitious monotones of the everyday, rather in the demi-poetry known as dialogue. Like an alchemist, a writer mixes and molds concoctions of character, conflict, and change, and then gilds them with dialogue, transforming the base metal of existence into the burnished gold of story. Once spoken, dialogue carries us on waves of sensation and substance that reverberate through the said, to the unsaid, to the unsayable. The said are those ideas and emotions a character chooses to express to others. The unsaid are those thoughts and feelings a character expresses in an inner voice, but only to himself. The unsayable are those subconscious urges and desires a character cannot express in words, even to himself, because they are mute and beyond awareness. No matter how lavish a play's production, how vivid a novel's descriptions, how lush a film's photography. Character talk shapes the deepest complexities, ironies, and innerness of story. Without expressive dialogue, events lack depth, characters lose dimension, and story flattens out. More than any other technique of characterization, gender, age, dress, class, casting, dialogue has the power to pull a story up through life's multi-layered strata, thus lifting a merely complicated telling into the full array of complexity. Do you, like me, memorize favorite lines? I think we learn dialogue passages by heart because reciting them again and again not only re-inspires the vivid word pictures they paint, but in the echoes of the characters' thoughts, we hear our own.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death.
Macbeth, in the tragedy of Macbeth. Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine. Rick, in Casablanca.
Towards thee I roll, thou all-destroying but unconquering whale. To the last I grapple with thee, from hell's heart I stab at thee. For hate's sake I spit my last breath at thee.
Ahab, in Moby Dick.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Jerry, in Seinfeld.
Like these four characters, each of us has suffered the scald of irony, that flash of insight into what the world has done to us, or worse yet, what we've done to ourselves, that double-edged moment when life's joke is on us and we don't know whether to grin or groan. But without writers to marinate these ironies in words, how could we savor their delicious distaste? Without the mnemonics of dialogue, how could we hold these paradoxes in memory? I love the art of dialogue in all of its variety. Moved by that enmity, I have written Dialogue, the Art of Verbal Action for Page, Stage, Screen, to explore the crowning act of story-making, giving voice to your characters. Introduction. Part 1. The Art of Dialogue radically expands the definition of dialogue and multiplies its usage. Chapters 2 through 5 look at the functions, content, forms, and techniques of character talk across the four major storytelling media. Part 2, Flaws and Fixes, pinpoints maladies from incredibility and cliches to writing on the nose and repetitiousness, seeks their causes, then prescribes cures. To illustrate the varied techniques of crafting dialogue, I cite examples from novels, plays, films, and television. Part 3, Creating Dialogue, examines the writer's final step, finding the words that create the text. When we say an author has an ear for dialogue, we mean he writes character-specific talk. Each of his characters speaks with a syntax, rhythm, tonality, and most importantly, word choices that no one but that character would use. Ideally, every character is a walking dictionary of his or her unique collection of words. Dialogue originality, therefore, begins with vocabulary. To illustrate the power of character-specific dialogue, we will look at scenes from Shakespeare's play, The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, Elmore Leonard's novel, Out of Sight, Tina Fey's television series, 30 Rock, and Alexander Payne and Jim Taylor's film, Sideways. Part 4, Dialogue Design, opens with a study of the components of story and scene design. Chapter 12 shows how these forms determine what characters say. Six case studies follow, using scenes of balanced conflict from the cable series The Sopranos, comic conflict from the network series Frasier, asymmetric conflict from the play A Raisin in the Sun, indirect conflict from the novel The Great Gatsby, reflexive conflict from the novels Fräulein Else and The Museum of Innocence, and implied conflict from the film Lost in Translation. In these scansions, we will look at the two primary principles of effective dialogue. First, each exchange of dialogue creates an action-reaction that progresses the scene. Second, although these actions find expression in the outer behavior of talk, the wellspring of character action flows invisibly from the subtext. Like a GPS for writers, dialogue, the art of verbal action, offers guidance to the aspirant and redirection to the perplexed. If you recently ventured into this art and find yourself backed into a creative cul-de-sac, dialogue will put you on the path to excellence. If you write for a living but have lost your bearings, this book will guide you home. Part 1. The Art of Dialogue. Chapter 1. The Full Definition of Dialogue. Dialogue. Any words said by any character to anyone. Tradition defines dialogue as talk between characters. I believe, however, that an all-encompassing, in-depth study of dialogue begins by stepping back to the widest possible view of storytelling. From that angle, the first thing I notice is that character talk runs along three distinctively different tracks: said to others, said to oneself, and said to the reader or audience. I place these three modes of talk under the term dialogue for two reasons. First, no matter when, where, or to whom a character speaks, the writer must personalize the role with a unique, character-specific voice worded in the text. Second, whether mental or vocal, whether thought inside the mind or said out into the world, all speech is an outward execution of inner action. All talk responds to a need, engages a purpose, and performs an action. No matter how seemingly vague and airy a speech may be, no character ever talks to anyone, even to himself, for no reason, to do nothing. Therefore, beneath every line of character talk, the writer must create a desire, intent, and action. That action, then, becomes the verbal tactic we call dialogue. Let's survey the three tracks of dialogue. One, talk to others. The accurate term for two-way talk is duologue. Three characters in conversation would generate a trialogue. A family of a dozen souls gathered for Thanksgiving Day dinner might be called a multilogue, if such a term existed. Two, talk within oneself. Screenwriters seldom ask characters to talk to themselves. Playwrights, on the other hand, often do. As for prose writers, mental talk is the stuff and substance of their art. Prose has the power to invade a character's mind and project inner conflict across the landscape of thought. Whenever an author tells his story in a first-person or second-person voice, that voice belongs to a character. Prose, therefore, often fills with reflexive, self-to-self dialogue that the reader, as it were, overhears. Three, talk to readers and audiences. In the theater, the conventions of soliloquy and aside allow characters to turn directly to the audience and talk in confidence. In television and film, this convention usually puts the character off screen to talk voice over, but occasionally calls for the character to turn to the camera in direct address. In prose, this is the essence of first-person prose. The character tells his tale to the reader. The etymology of the word dialogue traces back to two Greek terms, dia, meaning through, and legen, referring to speech. These two terms, translated directly into English, become the compound noun through speech, an action taken through words as opposed to deeds. Every line a character speaks, whether spoken aloud to others or silently in the mind, is, in J.L. Austin's term, a performative, words that perform a task. To say something is to do something, and for that reason, I have expanded my redefinition of dialogue to name any and all words said by a character to herself, to others, or to the reader audience as an action taken to satisfy a need or desire. In all three cases, when a character speaks, she acts verbally as opposed to physically, and each of her through-speech actions moves the scene she's in from one beat to the next, while at the same time it dynamically propels her closer to, positive, or further from, negative, the satisfaction of her core desire. Dialogue as action is the foundation principle of this book. Dialogue carries out its actions in one of two ways, dramatized or narratized. Dramatized dialogue. Dramatized means acted out in scenes. Whether the tone is comic or tragic, dramatized dialogue sends lines back and forth between characters in conflict. Each line contains an action with a specific intention and causes a reaction somewhere within the scene. This is true even in one character scenes. When someone says, "I'm mad at myself," who is mad at whom? Just as you see your image in a mirror, you can see yourself in your imagination. To argue within yourself, your mind creates a second self and talks to it as if it were another person. A character's inner dialogue becomes a dynamically dramatized scene between two conflicted selves of the same person, one of which may or may not win the argument. Therefore, strictly defined, all monologues are in fact dialogues. Whenever a character talks, she's always talking to someone, even if it's her other side. Narratized dialogue. Narratized means spoken outside the scene. In these cases, the so-called fourth wall of realism vanishes, and a character steps out of the story's dramatizations. Once again, strictly speaking, narratized speeches are not monologues, but dialogues in which the character takes vocal action to talk directly to the reader, audience, or self. In terms of desire, a first-person narrator in prose or a character narrating from the stage or screen may simply want to bring the reader, audience, up to date on past events and arouse their curiosity about future events. She may use narratized dialogue to act out this straightforward ambition and no more. In more complex situations, however, she might, for example, use words to arm-twist the reader, audience, into forgiving her past misdeeds while prejudicing them to see her enemies from her biased point of view. From story to story, the possible desires that might move a character to action and the tactics she uses while talking to the reader or audience seem unlimited. The same applies to a character who turns inside her mind to talk to herself. She may be pursuing any purpose, rerunning a memory for pleasure, puzzling out whether or not she can trust her lover's love, building her hopes by fantasizing about life to come, and so on, as her thoughts roam the past, present, and possible futures, real and imagined. To demonstrate how the same content could be expressed in three different modes of dialogue, I'll work with a passage from the novel Dr. Glass, written in 1905 by the Swedish author Helmar Söderberg. The book takes the form of a diary kept by the eponymous protagonist. A real-life diary records the closet conversations of a diarist talking to himself. A fictional diary, therefore, must be written so the reader feels that he somehow overhears these secret inner dialogues. In Soderbergh's novel, Dr. Glass wants to save one of his patients, a woman he secretly loves, from her sexually abusive husband. Day after day, his mind wages moral arguments for and against killing the man. In nightmare after nightmare, he commits the murder. Later in the book, he in fact poisons the husband. In an entry dated August 7th, a nightmare wakes him in a cold sweat. Listen in on his rambling, narratized dialogue as Glass tries to convince himself that his horrid dream is not a prophecy.
Dreams run like streams. Hoary proverbial wisdom, I know you well. And in reality, most of what one dreams is not worth a second thought. Loose fragments of experience, often the silliest and most indifferent fragments of those things consciousness has judged unworthy of preservation, but which, even so, go on living a shadow life of their own in the attics and box rooms of the mind. But there are other dreams. As a lad, I remember sitting a whole afternoon pondering a geometrical problem, and in the end having to go to bed with it still unresolved. Asleep, my brain went on working of its own accord, and a dream gave me the solution. And it was correct. Dreams there are, too, like bubbles from the depths. And now I come to think of it more clearly. Many a time has a dream taught me something about myself, often revealed to me wishes I did not wish to wish, desires of which I did not wish to take daylight cognizance. These wishes, these dreams, I've afterward weighed and tested in bright sunlight. But rarely have they stood up to daylight, and more often than not I've flung them back into the foul depths where they belong. In the night they might assail me anew, but I recognized them, and even in dreams laughed them to scorn, until they relinquished all claim to arise and live in reality and the light of day.
In the first line, Glass speaks to a proverb floating in his mind, as if the idea had a mind of its own. Then he turns to argue with his silent, dark, immoral side. A self that roils with murderous desire. By the last sentence, Glass thinks his better self has won the argument, at least for the moment. Notice how the sentences roll out in lengthy, cumulative shapes of rumination. Now, suppose Soderbergh had written this passage as narratized dialogue said by Dr. Glass directly to the reader. To write in a voice Glass might use while talking to another person, Soderbergh might give Glass that authoritative voice that doctors often use when prescribing to a patient. The sentences might shorten and turn into imperatives. Do's, don'ts, and buts might be added to give ideas a sharp twist.
Dreams run like streams. A proverb I know you've heard. Don't believe it. Most of what we dream isn't worth a second thought. These fragments of experience are the silly, indifferent things our consciousness judges unworthy. Even so, in the attic of your mind, they go on living a shadow life. That's unhealthy. But some dreams are useful. When I was a boy, I sat a whole afternoon pondering a geometrical problem. I went to bed with it unresolved. But in sleep, my brain went on working, and a dream gave me the solution. Then there are dangerous dreams that rise like bubbles from the depths. If you dare think about them, they seem to teach you something about yourself. A wish you didn't think you wished. A desire you didn't say out loud. Don't believe them. When weighed and tested, these dreams do not stand up to bright daylight. So do what a healthy person would do. Fling them back into the foul depths where they belong. If at night they assail you anew, laugh at them, until they relinquish all claim on your reality.
As a third choice, Soderbergh, who also wrote plays, may have chosen to dramatize these ideas on stage. He could have split the Doctor into two characters, Glass and Markle. In the novel, the journalist Markle is Glass's best friend. In a play, Markle might personify the morally righteous side of Glass, while Glass could play the tormented side that's tempted toward murder. In the subtext of the scene that follows, Glass seeks Markle's help to cure his troubling dreams. Sensing this, Markle makes positive moral statements in answer to the Doctor's questions. The text retains the novel's imagery, the theater, in fact, encourages figurative language, but it changes line design from cumulative to periodic to aid the actor's cueing. Chapter 5 takes up studies in line design. Glass and Markle sit in a cafe. As dusk turns to night, they sip after-dinner brandies.
Do you know the proverb, dreams run like streams?
Yes, my grandmother always said that. But in reality, most dreams are just fragments of the day, not worth keeping.
Worthless as they are, they live shadow lives in the attic of the mind.
In your mind, Doctor, not mine.
But don't you think dreams give us insights?
At times. When I was a lad, I spent a whole afternoon pondering a geometrical problem and went to bed with it unsolved. But my brain went on working, and a dream gave me a solution. Next morning I checked, and damned if it wasn't correct.
No, I mean something hidden. Insights into oneself, bubbles of truth from the depths. Those dark desires one wouldn't dare admit over breakfast.
If I ever had such, and I'm not saying I ever have, I'd fling them back into the foul depths where they belong.
And what if these desires came back, night after night?
Then I'd dream a dream of ridicule, and laugh them out of my thoughts.
These three versions contain the same essential content, but when what's said changes direction from told to self, to told to the reader, to told to another character, language radically changes shape, diction, tonality, and texture. The three fundamental dialogue modes require three sharply contrasted writing styles. Dialogue and the major media. All dialogue, dramatized and narratized, performs in the grand symphony of story. But from stage to screen to page, its instruments and arrangements vary considerably. For that reason, a writer's choice of medium greatly influences the composition of dialogue, its qualities and quantities. The theater, for example, is primarily an auditory medium. It prompts audience members to listen more intently than they watch. As a result, the stage favors voice over image. Cinema reverses that. Film is primarily a visual medium. It prompts the audience to watch more intently than it listens. For that reason, screenplays favor image over voice. The aesthetics of television float between the theater and cinema. Teleplays tend to balance voice and image, inviting us to look and listen more or less equally. Prose is a mental medium. Where a story is performed on stage and on screen, strike the audience's eyes and ears directly, literature takes an indirect path through the reader's mind. The reader must first interpret the language, then imagine the sights and sounds it describes. Every reader's imaginings are her own. And finally, allow herself to react to what she envisions. What's more, because literary characters are actorless, the author is free to use as much or little dialogue, as dramatized or narratized, as he sees fit. So, let's look at how a story's medium shapes its dialogue. Dialogue on stage. Dramatized dialogue. The scene is the basic unit of story structure in all four major story media. In the theater, the majority of talk plays out as dramatized dialogue performed by characters in scenes with other characters. The one-character play is no exception. When a lone character paces the stage, he creates scenes of inner dramatized dialogue by splitting himself in two, as it were, and pitting his warring selves against each other. If the character sits back to air his thoughts, these memories, fantasies, and philosophies play best as inner actions, motivated by a desire and taken with a purpose. No matter how passive and aimless such musings may seem on the surface, they are in fact dramatized dialogue, said within a scene by a conflicted character struggling within himself to understand himself, or forget the past, or sell himself on a lie, or any other interaction a playwright might invent. Samuel Beckett's Crap's Last Tape stands as a brilliant example of dramatized dialogue in a one-character play. Narratized dialogue. In keeping with the theater's ancient conventions, a playwright may employ narratized dialogue by stepping his character out of the flux of scenes and turning him to the audience to speak in soliloquy or, if very brief, in an aside. What's revealed is often a confession, a secret, or a revelation of what a character genuinely thinks, feels, or wants to do, but could never say aloud to another character. For example, the painful contritions of Tom Wingfield in Tennessee Williams's The Glass Menagerie. In one-person performances like The Year of Magical Thinking, Mark Twain Tonight, or I Am My Own Wife, the soliloquy becomes an entire play. These works often stage adaptations of biographies or autobiographies, and so the actor plays a well-known contemporary, Joan Didion, or a personage from the past, Mark Twain. In the course of the evening, the actor may use all three forms of character talk. For the most part, however, he will confess his story to the audience in narratized dialogue. Now and then, he might impersonate other characters and act out scenes from the past in dramatized dialogue. Modern stand-up comedy came of age when comics moved from joke-telling to narratized dialogue. A stand-up comedian must either invent a character to play, Stephen Colbert, or perform a selected characterized version of himself, Louis C.K. For this reason, no one can step on stage as the exact same self that got out of bed that morning. It takes a persona to perform. On stage, the line between dramatized and narratized dialogue can shift, depending on the actor's interpretation. When Hamlet, for example, questions his continued existence, does he aim the phrase to be or not to be at the audience or at himself? It's the actor's choice. Narration. On those occasions when a play story encompasses a large cast over decades of time, a playwright may stand a narrator at the side of the stage. These non-characters perform any number of tasks. They relate historical exposition, introduce characters, or counterpoint the action with ideas or interpretations that could not be directly dramatized in scenes. For example, in Donald Hall's An Evening's Frost, an enactment of the life of poet Robert Frost, and Erwin Pescador's epic theater adaptation of Tolstoy's War and Peace, onstage narrators bring a godlike knowledge of history and personae to the audience, but they have no personal desires. They stand above the drama, facilitating the storytelling. By contrast, in Our Town, playwright Thornton Wilder's narrator, known as the stage manager, mixes functions. He narrates exposition, guides the audience's attitudes, but from time to time he steps into dramatized scenes to play some small parts. Dialogue on screen. dramatized dialogue. Like the theater, the majority of on-screen talk is dramatized dialogue, spoken in character, on camera, in live action, or voiced off camera in animation. Narratized dialogue. Screen characters narratize dialogue in one of two modes, either off-camera voiceover over the images or direct-to-camera in cinematic soliloquy. Off-camera, self-narrating characters have been a staple since the movies began. Sometimes they speak in calm, logical, reliable voices, How I Met Your Mother. Sometimes they rant in hysterical, irrational, and unreliable outbursts, Pi. Sometimes they make sense out of bewildering events, Memento. Sometimes they counterpoint events, The Big Lebowski. Some characters expose painfully honest thoughts in dramatized dialogues with their inner selves, Adaptation. Some hide their secret self behind excuses and rationalizations, A Clockwork Orange. Some comment on their predicaments with wit, My Name is Earl. When characters look down the camera lens and whisper something secret and personal, it's usually a self-serving tactic to win us to their side, House of Cards. Since Bob Hope, comedians have tossed lines and looks to camera to punch jokes. It's Gary Shandling's show. And the greatest of all, Woody Allen, uses narratized dialogue both off-camera and to-camera to charm our empathy and sting gags. Annie Hall. In Ingmar Bergman's Winter Light, a woman, played by Ingrid Tulin, sends her ex-lover, Gunnar Bjornstrand, a letter describing his cowardly failure to love her. As he picks it up to read, Bergman cuts to her face in close-up as she speaks the letter, eyes direct to camera, for 6 uninterrupted minutes. Bergman's subjective camera transports us into the ex-lover's imagination, so that as he envisions her speaking, we identify with him and his suffering, while Ingrid Tulin's work to camera ignites their intimacy. Narration. In films such as Barry Lyndon, Amelie, and Y Tu Mama Tambien, non-character off-screen narrators with resonant, articulate voices, Sir Michael Horden, André Ducellier, Daniel Jiménez-Cacho, respectively, link episodes, fill in exposition, and counterpoint the telling. Counterpoint narration imports ideas and insights from outside the story's world to add dimension and depth to the telling. A narrator, for example, might lead comedy with drama or leaven drama with comedy. He might punctuate delusion with reality or reality with fantasy. His comments might play the political world off against the private realm or the reverse. As often as not, the ironic observations of this non-character rescues a film from sentimentality by undercutting the emotional indulgences of its characters. For example, Tom Jones. Dialogue on page. Stories performed on stage and on screen move through the physical media of air and light, and then enter the mind through the senses of sight and sound. Stories performed in prose move through the mental medium of language to find life in the reader's imagination. Because the imagination is far more complex, multifaceted, and multi-leveled than the senses, literature offers a greater variety and flexibility of dialogue techniques than the theater, television, or cinema. Stories in prose can be told from either inside the story's world by a character or from outside the story's world by a narrator. This simple division, however, becomes further complicated by literature's 3 point of view choices, first, second, and third person. First person. In a first person telling, a character who refers to herself with the pronouns I or me speaks to the reader about events as she remembers them. She may describe these events or present them dramatically, as scenes in which she and other characters talk directly among themselves. She may also turn inward and talk to herself. If so, the reader comes along with her to overhear, as it were, her self-to-self conversations. Because the first-person narrator is a character involved in the story, she is an imperfect witness to the life around her, unable to comprehend events in their entirety, often less than objective as she pursues her unspoken or subconscious desires. For this reason, the reliability of first-person narrators spans a wide spectrum from trustworthy to deceitful. What's more, the first-person narrator is often more focused on herself than others, so her interactions, self-observations, and ruminations tend to fill the page. The inner life of other characters, therefore, can only be known by the first-person narrator's speculations or implications the reader draws from between the lines. An omniscient first-person narrator with preternatural insight into the thoughts and feelings of other characters is a rare device. This conceit needs an exceptional explanation. In The Lovely Bones by Alice Sebold, for example, the first-person narrator is the spirit of a murdered girl who looks down from her otherworldly vantage and sees into the hearts of her family as they struggle with her disappearance. A first-person narrator could be the story's protagonist, Brother William of Baskerville, in The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, a confidant to the protagonist, Dr. Watson to Sherlock Holmes, a group speaking in first-person plural, The Virgin Suicides by Jeffrey Eugenides, or a distant observer, Joseph Conrad's unnamed narrator in Heart of Darkness. Third person. In a third-person telling, a narrating intelligence guides the reader through the story's events. This intelligence often has deep insight into the thoughts and feelings of all characters. Even though this awareness is not a character, it may have strong opinions, moral or otherwise, about the fictional world and its society, yet, by convention, it maintains a distance by referring to the cast with the pronouns her, he, and they. Because this third-person intelligence is not a character, its narration is not dialogue, nor is it the transcribed voice of the writer. No one, even the most eloquent talk show host on NPR, goes through life talking in a third-person voice. This non-character may be more or less compassionate than its author, more or less political, more or less observant, more or less moral. Whatever the case, in the same fashion the prose writer creates a voice for each of her characters, she invents a linguistic manner for narration, knowing that in the same way that audiences put themselves in the hands of on-stage and off-screen narrators, the reader accepts narration as a storytelling convention, character-less and dialogue-less. The language used by this intelligence may be profoundly expressive. The reader may listen to it in her imagination as if it were someone's voice, but it is not. Only characters have true voices. What we call a third-person narrator's voice is simply the author's literary style. That is why the reader feels neither empathy for this voice nor curiosity about the fate of the consciousness behind it. The reader knows via conventions older than Homer that the author invented this non-character for the sole purpose of putting the telling into language that the reader can follow. If, on the other hand, this intelligence should suddenly refer to itself as I, a non-character would become a character, and the telling would shift into first person. The breadth of knowledge in third-person narrators ranges from omniscient to limited, their judgment from morally neutral to morally critical, their presence in the mind of the reader from overt to covert, their reliability from truthful to, in very rare cases, deceitful. As the prose writer plays with these dimensions, he can shade his third-person narrators with degrees of objectivity versus subjectivity, ranging from ironically detached to deeply invested. The third-person objective mode, also known as covert or dramatic, shows far more than it tells. It observes but never interprets. This awareness sits back like a patron in the theater of life, never entering inner realms, never describing the thoughts and feelings of any character. Famous examples? Ernest Hemingway's short stories such as Hills Like White Elephants and The Snows of Kilimanjaro. In the mid-20th century, the French Nouveau Roman took this technique to its absolute limits in works such as Jealousy by Alain Robbe-Grillet. The third-person subjective mode penetrates the inner life and may switch between the thoughts and feelings of more than one character. More often than not, however, the author restricts access to the inner life of the story's protagonist only. This mode may feel something like first person, but keeps its distance by using the impersonal pronouns he and she rather than I. In George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series, for example, each chapter takes up a separate storyline, each restricted to the point of view of that tale's protagonist. This technique of subjective exploration, in both its limited and omniscient variants, became the most popular narrative perspective in 20th century prose. A subjective narrator may come with a touch of personality and overt opinions, for example, the passage from The Corrections that we'll hear in a moment, but no matter how playful or sarcastic, how familiar or personal a third-person narrator may be, this voice is the author's creature, a special dimension of himself that he invents to convey his story from outside its events. An author may even choose to let his narrator break the bond of trust that millennia of poetry and prose has built between writers and their readers. In rare tellings, writers have given this voice character-like traits of confusion or duplicity. But once again, no matter how manipulative, unreliable, or uncertain a third-person narrator may become, its language is not dialogue. This is an author speaking from behind a mask. Third-person narration requires unique strategies and techniques that are outside the focus of this book. Second person. The second person mode is a disguise for either the first person or the third person. In this mode, the storytelling voice eliminates the pronouns I and me of the first person and she, he, or they of third person to address someone as you. This you could be the protagonist himself. When, for example, a person berates himself with the thought, "You idiot," one aspect of the self criticizes another aspect. A second-person voice, therefore, could be analyzing or encouraging or reminiscing with himself. Second Thoughts, for example, by Michel Buter. Or, you could be a silent, unnamed other character, thus turning the telling into a one-sided dramatized dialogue. A Song of Stone, for example, by Ian Banks. Or, in the third possibility, you could be the reader. In J. McInerney's novel, Bright Lights, Big City, an ineffable awareness takes the reader through the story in the present tense until the reader feels as if he's acting out the events himself.
You're not sure exactly where you are going. You don't feel you have the strength to walk home. You walk faster. If the sunlight catches you on the streets, you will undergo some terrible chemical change.
After a few minutes, you notice the blood on your fingers. You hold your hand up to your face. There is blood on your shirt, too. You find a Kleenex in your jacket pocket and hold it up to your nose. You advance with your head tilted back against your shoulders.
If this passage were rewritten into the past tense, with you switched to I, it would become a conventional first-person novel. If you were changed to he, it would become a conventional third-person telling. The second-person present tense makes this tale ambiguously both, and moves through a filmic atmosphere akin to subjective camera. To help clarify this complexity, let's compare the conventions of prose to their equivalent on stage and on screen. Dramatized dialogue. Dramatized scenes in prose can be written from any of the three points of view, first, second, or third person. In all three voices, scenes take place in their temporal and spatial settings, the characters and their behaviors are described, and their talk is quoted verbatim. Conceivably, such scenes could be lifted off the page and transported, more or less intact, to a theater or a soundstage to be performed by actors. Narratized dialogue. Everything said outside of dramatized scenes in the first or second person voice is, by my definition, narratized dialogue. These passages are spoken in character, with a story-driven purpose, and affect the reader much like an onstage soliloquy or a direct-to-camera address. When narratized dialogue modulates into stream of consciousness, the pages read like an inner monologue in a play, or a protagonist's voiceover in films like Memento and Pi. In all instances, the author writes in character. Indirect dialogue. All four major media offer the writer the choice to either recall scenes from the past and describe them, or to put them in front of the reader or audience and act them out. If he chooses description, what could have been a scene of dramatized dialogue turns into indirect dialogue. Should the writer use a character to describe a prior scene, then her immediate dialogue paraphrases another character's previous dialogue. For example, in this passage from Bruce Norris's play Clyburn Park, Bev complains about her husband.
Bev, the way he sits up all night long. Last night he was just sitting there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I say to him, "Say, don't you feel sleepy? Do you want to take a Somanax or play some cards, maybe?" And he says, "I don't see the point of it." As if there has to be some grand justification for every single thing that a person does.
The audience can only guess at the accuracy of her paraphrases, but in this context, exactly what was said is not important. Norris uses indirect dialogue so that the audience hears what is important, Bev's interpretation of her husband's behavior in her own words. When third-person narration paraphrases dialogue, once again the reader must interpret how it sounded when spoken. This scene, for example, between a husband and a wife from Jonathan Franzen's novel The Corrections.
Made happy by pregnancy, she got sloppy and talked about the wrong thing to Alfred. Not, needless to say, about sex or fulfillment or fairness. But there were other topics scarcely less forbidden, and Enid, in her giddiness one morning, overstepped. She suggested he buy shares in a certain stock. Alfred said the stock market was a lot of dangerous nonsense, best left to wealthy men and idle speculators. Enid suggested he nonetheless buy shares of a certain stock. Alfred said he remembered Black Tuesday as if it were yesterday. Enid suggested he nonetheless buy shares of a certain stock. Alfred said it would be highly improper to buy that stock. Enid suggested he nonetheless buy it. Alfred said they had no money to spare, and now a third child coming. Enid suggested that the money could be borrowed. Alfred said no. He said no in a much louder voice, and stood up from the breakfast table. He said no so loudly that a decorative copper plate bowl on the kitchen wall briefly hummed, and without kissing her goodbye, he left the house for 11 days and 10 nights.
By repeating the word suggested 5 times, Franzen pushes Enid's nagging and Alfred's rage to the edge of farce. The phrase 11 days and 10 nights presages their holiday cruise, and the image of a bowl humming on the wall pushes the scene beyond farce to absurdity. Because indirect dialogue invites the reader to imagine the scene, the heated, possibly melodramatic language of direct dialogue becomes a more personalized, believable version invented by the reader. Chapter 2. The Three Functions of Dialogue. Dialogue, dramatized and narratized, performs 3 essential functions: exposition, characterization, action. Exposition. Exposition is a term of art that names the fictional facts of setting, history, and character that readers and audiences need to absorb at some point so they can follow the story and involve themselves in its outcome. A writer can embed exposition in the telling in only 1 of 2 ways: description or dialogue. On stage and on screen, directors and their designers interpret the writer's descriptions into every expressive element that isn't dialogue: settings, costumes, lighting, props, sound effects, and the like. Comic book artists and graphic novelists illustrate their stories as they tell them. Prose authors compose literary descriptions that project word images into the reader's imagination. Dialogue can do the same work. For example, picture this: a gilt-gleaming, marbled lobby with business-dressed, fair-haired visitors signing in at a security desk, manned by uniformed guards, while in the background, busy elevators open and close. The moment we glimpse this image, it instantly denotes a number of expositional facts. Place: an office building in a major city somewhere in the Northern Hemisphere. Time: a weekday between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. Society: the professional class of Western culture that hires armed guards to protect the executives on the upper floors from the poverty class on the streets. What's more, the subtext of this image connotes a commercial, competitive, white male-dominated world questing for wealth and power, always on the verge of corruption. Now, picture a high-energy investment broker lunching with a potential client. Listen for the implications beneath his glib double entendre.
"Come on up, meet my young hawks. We roost on the 77th floor and prey on Wall Street."
In fewer graphemes than a tweet, word pictures can express more dimensions than a camera can see. Virtually anything expressed in images or explained in narration can be implied in dialogue. Therefore, the first function of dialogue is to pass exposition to the eavesdropping reader or audience. The following precepts guide this difficult work: pacing and timing. Pacing means the rate or frequency with which exposition is spliced into the telling. Timing means choosing the precise scene and the exact line within that scene to reveal a specific fact. The risks governing the pacing and timing of exposition are these: give the storygoer too little exposition, and he will disengage in confusion. On the other hand, big helpings of static exposition choke interest. The reader puts down the book, audiences shift in their seats, wishing they'd brought more popcorn. Therefore, you must pace and time the placement of exposition with care and skill. To keep interest moving, fine writers parse exposition out detail by detail, passing on only what the audience member needs or reader needs to know when she absolutely needs and wants to know it, not a moment before. They give only the minimal exposition necessary to maintain the flow of curiosity and empathy. If you give the modern, story-savvy reader or audience too much exposition too soon, not only does their stride shuffle to a crawl, but they also foresee your turning points, including your ending, long before they happen. Annoyed and disappointed, they sit in front of your work thinking, "I saw it coming." As the 19th century novelist Charles